Good morning. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, with today's Wall Street Journal. Russia. Returning Russian POWs pay heavy price for choosing surrender over death. Joy over homecoming is short-lived as returning prisoners face insults, cut pay, and orders to return to front line. By Milan Cerzani, Thomas Grove, and Daria Matvinchuk. When a self-described patriotic middle-aged Russian soldier was released from a prisoner of war camp in Ukraine earlier this year, he called his family to tell them he was alive, free, and back on Russian soil. As the phone was passed around, he told them he might be back in time for his son's birthday in a few weeks' time. He never made it. Instead, he was subjected to weeks of questioning by Russia's security services, then sent back to the front. Soon he went missing again on the front lines near the occupied Ukrainian city of Donetsk. This time, his relatives fear he is dead. One likened the situation to being caught in a circle of hell. Across Russian towns and cities, authorities have celebrated the patriotism of volunteers who signed up to Russian President Vladimir Putin's war. Veterans who return from the front are sometimes lionized on television and promised privileged positions in the local and regional governments of an increasingly militarized Russia. But the fate of Russia's POWs has been an overlooked chapter of Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. Before soldiers are even sent to the front, their commanders admonish them to blow themselves up with a grenade before submitting to Ukrainian capture. Russian rapper Dmitry Konetskov, known as Husky, shared the sentiment in his new album. "I won't be taken prisoner, in my left hand a grenade, in my right a grenade," he rapped in one track. POWs and their families say the joy of coming home is short-lived. Those who chose to surrender face a return fraught with suspicion and shame. Salaries and one-time bonuses were a chief reason why so many agreed to go to war, but they can be cut off as soon as they are captured. Thousands are now in financial limbo. "The country is at war," said Valery Vedoshenko, a lawyer associated with Russian non-governmental OVD Info, a legal aid group. "The state does not encourage voluntary surrender. When soldiers are returned to Russia, they are bused from Belarus bordering Russia and Ukraine, when most exchanges occur. Apart from periodic phone calls, they are isolated from their families for as long as a month while they are interrogated by the Federal Security Service, or FSB, the Military Prosecutor's Office, and Russia's Investigative Committee. In some cases, the officers are meant to sniff out any scent of treason or collaboration. In others, investigators are probing for criminal offenses. In 2022, amid the country's chaotic mass mobilization, Russia criminalized voluntary surrender in hopes of discouraging the hundreds of thousands of draftees from simply giving themselves up. Earlier this year, one of the first criminal cases into surrender was open when a Russian soldier, Roman Evanchin, was sentenced to 15 years in a high-security penal colony after returning from Ukrainian captivity as part of a prisoner swap. The charges included voluntary surrender, attempting to voluntarily surrender, and desertion from a military unit. After their month-long interrogation, most are sent back to their units. Some are never given a rifle again and are condemned instead to cleaning and endless drills. Others are sent immediately back to the front, and where former prisoners and their families are accused unit commanders of either meting out punishment or sending the soldiers back into dangerous missions. The conditions upon return can be so dire that some families have lobbied to keep their sons out of prisoner exchanges. The conditions in Ukrainian POW camps are much more humane than in Russian POW camps for Ukrainians, where torture has been at times systemic. The Kremlin didn't respond to a request for comment. In August, word reached back home that Igor Dologopov, 31 years old, had been made a prisoner of war after being deployed to Chasiv Yar in eastern Ukraine. His relatives say they fear he may be included in any future swaps and then sent directly back to the front. One of Dolgopolov's relatives said soldiers returned from a POW camp are no longer trusted and are humiliated and denounced by their unit commanders back home. The person said it would be better for them to stay and live in Ukraine and even take citizenship there. According to the Geneva Conventions, to which Russia is a party, former POWs can't be employed on active military service, only in auxiliary roles. A Russian Ministry of Defense paper viewed by the Wall Street Journal argues that some of the provisions of the Geneva Convention don't apply to Russian POWs as the war is continuing. Russia's attitudes towards POWs carries echoes of World War II, when POWs were viewed with suspicion and numerous orders made it illegal to surrender in the face of advancing Nazi soldiers. A phrase attributed to Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin was carried through popular culture. We have no prisoners, only traitors. It still rings true today. Earlier this year, a former POW, Pavel Gorognev, 45, was tried for cooperating with a foreign government. He faces a sentence of up to 8 years after giving a series of interviews to Ukrainian journalists about his detention, his disapproval of the war, and the conditions he suffered once he got back. In one video, about a month after he was exchanged and sent back to Russia, he said he had been interrogated by the FSB and sent to a military hospital in Podolsk, a town south of Moscow. He said other soldiers asked him why he didn't blow himself up instead of allowing himself to be captured. Gugov said the FSB called returned soldiers lost trust and that prisoners sent back to the front lines were given menial tasks that didn't involve firearms as they were no longer trusted. They don't let Zeke's go home, he said, using the prison slang for prisoners. They use them like workers. Conversations with several POWs showed a similar pattern of mistrust. Once back in Russia, they are questioned, barred from going home to see their families, and sent directly back to their commanders. One POW who said he has been diagnosed with depression said he hasn't received the appropriate medical care or been allowed to see his family, but he also hasn't been sent back to the front. Instead, his days are filled with menial tasks or guard duty. Another soldier said he has boarded a plane to deploy back to the front, but was removed just before takeoff in front of his fellow soldiers because his superiors didn't trust him. "Oh, you're a prisoner of war," he recounted the officer saying. "Then they took me off the plane. That was it." Media. CBS News pulls 60 Minutes segment. Correspondent calls decision political. News organization says the segment about El Salvador prison, where Trump administration sent deportees, needed additional reporting by Isabella Simonetti. CBS News pulled a planned 60-minute segment on an El Salvadoran maximum security prison where the Trump administration sent hundreds of Venezuelan migrants, a last-minute decision that drew a rebuke from one of its high-profile correspondents. Sharon Alfonsi said in a Sunday email to fellow correspondents, including Leslie Stahl, Scott Pelley, and Anderson Cooper, that she learned Saturday that new CBS News editor-in-chief Barry Weiss spiked our story. Alfonsi said the last-minute change was, in her view, a political decision rather than an editorial call, according to the email, which was reviewed by the Wall Street Journal. "My job is to make sure that all stories we publish are the best they can be," Weiss said in a statement. "Holding stories that aren't ready for whatever reason, that they lack sufficient context, say, or that they are missing critical voices, happens every day in every newsroom. I look forward to airing this important piece when it's ready." Over the course of this weekend, Weiss made the decision not to run the piece as planned, according to people familiar with the matter. The 60 Minutes report on Inside CECOT will air in a future broadcast. "We determined it needed additional reporting," a spokesperson for CBS News said in a statement. "Our story was screened 5 times and cleared by both CBS attorneys and Standards and Practices. It is factually correct," Alfonsi wrote in the email. If the standards for airing a story became the government agreeing to be interviewed, she wrote, the network would cede editorial control. We go from an investigative powerhouse to a stenographer for the state, Alfonsi wrote. CBS parent Paramount purchased Weiss's news and opinion site, The Free Press, for $150 million earlier this year. At the time of her appointment, David Ellison said he hired Weiss to bring to CBS news that reflects reality and journalism that doesn't seek to demonize but seeks to understand. CBS advertised a segment on Friday showcasing Alfonsi's interviews with some of the deported migrants who had since been released from the mega prisons, saying they described the brutal and tortuous conditions they endured. The Trump administration earlier this year deported alleged Venezuelan gang members to El Salvador's Terrorism Confinement Center, a sprawling compound known as CECOT. A federal judge in June said the administration must allow the migrants it shipped there an opportunity to challenge their removal from the U.S. Weiss, who began her role as editor-in-chief of CBS News in October, has been involved in booking guests and recruiting talent while she sets the stage for a broad overhaul of the news network. She recently launched a new town hall series, the first of which featured Erica Kirk, the widow of Charlie Kirk, the conservative activist who was killed earlier this year. She recently named Tony Ducobul as the next anchor of CBS Evening News and brought on Matt Gutman, a longtime ABC News journalist, as chief correspondent. Entrepreneurship. These teenagers are already running their own AI companies. They may not yet drive, but they're getting an early start in business by leveraging vibe coding and social media. By Katherine Binley. Like any good tech founder, Nick Dobrynski puts in late nights and early mornings working on his startup, but this particular founder doesn't have much choice. Between 8 a.m. and 2:55 p.m., he's in high school. He's 15. Around the end of 8th grade, I wanted to make some sort of business, said Dobrynski, a sophomore in Semonish, Washington. I just spent a long time thinking about what problems there are that could be fixed with AI. With a little market research help from his mom, who works in finance, and some early technical guidance from his dad, who works in AI at a big tech company, he landed on the idea of using AI models to generate reports on small and mid-cap publicly traded companies. The result is Beyond SPX, an AI-based financial research platform. Young and hungry entrepreneurs are nothing new. Bill Gates was 19 when he co-founded Microsoft. Mark Zuckerberg was the same age when he started Facebook. But today's founders might well have a learner's permit and a mouthful of braces. Some got their start attending robotics camps or building games on Roblox platform. One got his feet wet breaking into candy distribution. Ever considered selling Gobstoppers to middle schoolers in Singapore? It's a cash cow. AI has fast-tracked both their interest in building a company and their ability to do it. Startup incubator Y Combinator doesn't have an age minimum to apply. Posting the right type of content might draw the attention of venture capital firms on the lookout for young talent. VCs might not be ready to hand you millions, but they would like to get to know you and perhaps stay in touch. Dobrynski said he has only handled around 10 lines of code and doesn't have any employees. He prompts Anthropic's Claude to generate the software and uses a combination of models, including ChatGPT and Gemini. He doesn't currently see the value in recruiting a marketing team. I use Reddit bots, he said. If somebody asks for the best investing tools, then my bot will comment. There's a bunch of investing tools, and Beyond SPX is one of them. He says he now has more than 50,000 monthly users of the platform, which is free. Dobrynski plans to start charging users eventually. Greystone Logistics, a company covered by Beyond SPX, put out a press release touting the independent analysis. I actually thought to myself, maybe this guy just unleashed AI on every small cap company, said Brendan Hopkins, an independent investor relations consultant who works with Greystone. I said, well, it's a really good synopsis and it's pretty positive. Let's put it out there, he says. He didn't know the platform's founder was 15. Kulvira Tagar, a venture capitalist based in San Francisco, says the age of founders has been trending down over the past few years, around the same time that ChatGPT and Claude became popular. It's more common for him to get cold business pitch emails from teens. Tagar says that it's partially because building great software at scale is getting easier now. And while distribution is still a challenge, he said younger founders might have it in their heads that if they've mastered TikTok or X, they can handle that part too. There's an impatience and a mentality of, I can't wait X amount of years to do it. The opportunity is now, says Tagar, adding, there's definitely something about AI making it feel like you just can learn very quickly. One company Tagar invested in was co-founded by Raghunath Arora, who was accepted into Y Combinator in May as a 16-year-old. Arora launched his first entrepreneurial venture as a student in Singapore. He tracked down U.S. candy that was hard to find in Asia and sold it to his classmates. It earned him good cash and 3 days of detention. The endeavor taught him the ropes of product distribution and how to maximize profit by cutting out middlemen. He started selling to mom-and-pop grocers in Singapore, too. I was marking these different items up by 50%, said Aurora, now 17. Aurora's latest company, GetASAP, distributes produce using AI to forecast inventories for grocers. The startup, which has 48 employees, secures fruits and vegetables directly from farmers and then delivers them to stores in U.S. and Asia. He and his 20-year-old co-founder secured $3.4 million in pre-seed funding and a round led by General Catalyst. Aurora didn't finish high school and now lives in Southern California. Ali Partovi, who runs a San Francisco venture firm and startup Alex accelerator called Neo, has spent years investing in young founders, often visiting college campuses to scout promising talent. Neo led the first investment round in Cursor, maker of a wildly popular AI coding product. While Partovi admires the hustle of high school entrepreneurs, he's hesitant to invest in one. High school might be a good time to conceive of ideas, but college is where you find the network of co-founders and early employees crucial to a startup's success. The only thing I'm focused on is this person going to attract people smarter than them, he says. But these young founders are worth watching, he adds. I would love to invest in their second startup. A general partner at Google Ventures recently met with a team of three co-founders. Two are 20 and one is 17. The partner realized if the firm were to invest, he'd probably need to chat with the minor's parents to see if he was really emotionally prepared for the founder's journey and all the struggles that come with it. While he's bullish on founders getting younger as a result of AI, not everyone can handle the stress at such a young age. Albie Chernvine, 14, and an eighth grader based in Sydney, Australia, was inspired after seeing app-building teen entrepreneurs take off on social media. He got his start selling soccer socks online and building Roblox games. At first, to be honest with you, it was purely a money thing, he says. But as I started doing it more and more, I actually liked doing it. Chirving got recently applied to Y Combinator. His application video, which included a 6-7 joke, generated millions of views on X. On a recent trip to San Francisco, he met with venture capitalists and other founders. Chirving's first startup, Finkle, was a gamified education app. He has since stepped away from it after realizing the idea wouldn't scale. Like any good founder, Chirvin quickly pivoted to his backup idea, an AI tool that generates app and website code. He has paired with co-founder and started to build the product and is now networking. If AI coding tools are enabling a whole new generation of founders, Chirvin wants to be building and selling those tools. I want to capitalize on it, he says. Otto's, one of Elon Musk's old enemies, joins the race to run GM. Robotics guru Sterling Anderson is now one of General Motors' top executives and shaking up the ranks. by Sharon Turlip and Suzanne Varenka. Sterling Anderson clashed with Elon Musk and left Tesla to launch a startup that has put self-driving trucks on the road. This summer, he took a top job at General Motors. Now, the robotics guru is seen by senior GM leaders as a dark horse candidate to succeed Chief Executive Mary Barra, who has led the automaker for more than a decade and turned 64 this week. Anderson's 42 years old. Joined GM in June as its global products chief, overseeing the development of all gas-powered and electric vehicles. He has expanded his influence in recent months, taking over units that develop artificial intelligence and integrate software into GM vehicles. His rise is shaking up succession landscape, complicated by years of tumult and turnover in GM's headquarters. Anderson's decision to leave Aurora Innovation, the self-driving trucking company he co-founded and that is now valued at $8 billion, to join the ranks of GM, left some puzzled. Sterling saw GM as kind of a company that had lost its way a little bit and saw an opportunity to go and help, said Aurora co-founder and CEO Chris Urmson. He thought he could go there and help point the right direction. Barrera has run GM since 2014. A tenure that is more than double the median S&P 500 CEO's term. She introduced EV models and steered the giant through the Trump administration's tariffs. Asked recently during an on-stage interview about how long she plans to remain at GM, Barrera said, "That's the board's decision, not mine." A GM spokeswoman said there has been no discussion of Barrera leaving. As for Anderson, she said, "Any discussion of a future role is premature and speculative." Several other GM executives are also seen by investors as candidates for the top job. They include Finance Chief Paul Jacobson and Mark Gross, a 40-year GM veteran and Barra's number two. Other would-be CEO candidates have left the company in recent years, among them Divya Sarvadera, a high-profile finance chief in 2020, Dan Ammann, Barra's former number two in 2021, and Marissa West, a rising star who left last year just 8 months after joining GM's senior leadership team. In choosing its next leader, the automaker's board faces a fundamental question: is GM a tech company capable of competing with Tesla and Waymo, or an old-school vehicle manufacturer married to a large gas-guzzling vehicles? Barrera prefers the former, and Anderson is the latest in a string of Silicon Valley transplants she has hired at GM. The newcomer is one of a small group of executives who sits on GM's influential executive strategy team. Anderson, however, is a relative unknown on Wall Street, especially compared with Jacobson, who is a former Delta Airlines CFO, and Royce, who was a contender for the CEO title when it went to Barra. The Silicon Valley aura has proven elusive to GM, as it has to other automakers chasing the same strategy. The company ditched plans last year for its Cruise robotaxi program after spending $10 billion and a decade on its development. It has suffered setbacks around its EV and autonomous driving strategies. The company in October booked a $1.6 billion charge on its EV business as demand for the vehicles sinks. A parade of executives plucked from Apple, Google, and Tesla have come and gone in quick succession, while GM lags behind Waymo and Chinese players such as Baidu and WeRide in developing a system that allows drivers to take their eyes off the road. The way things are going, you just want someone from Silicon Valley to stick around for more than 6 to 9 months, said Morningstar analyst David Whiston, who has covered the automotive industry since 2007. Since Anderson joined, a trio of high-ranking tech executives have left GM. One of them, the company's software engineering chief, left a week after appearing on stage alongside Anderson and Barrera to roll out a new tech strategy. "Our strategy is bigger than any one leader, and it's working," the GM spokeswoman said. A new tech strategy helmed by Anderson aims to bring eyes off driving to the market in 2028. In an electric Cadillac SUV, it also includes making a lower cost battery and introducing artificial intelligence into GM vehicles like the Chevy Silverado. A soft-spoken technophile with a doctorate in robotics from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Anderson has a collection of patents and papers on autonomous technology. Asked recently to outline GM's tech strategy, he described a vision of future electronic vehicles which with much higher computational ceiling or headroom. He went on to clarify what effectively that means for you practically in your life is that your car will get better the longer you own it. Within GM, Anderson's arrival was cheered by many employees involved in the automaker's self-driving technology, still stinging from GM's move last year to end the Cruise program. Anderson has rehired some key Cruise staffers and, in internal meetings, praised the unit and its progress on the technology. Cruise was an early mover in the robo-taxi race, but its reputation suffered from alarming mishaps and in an accident in California that prompted GM to pull the cars from several markets. The automaker said it scrapped the program because of rising competition and costs. Employees in wider parts of the GM universe are less sold on Anderson. Some question the wisdom of bringing back Cruise leaders given missteps at the unit. The new boss irked some within GM's ranks when, in recent town hall, he defended the company's use of a controversial performance ranking system to grade employees. Anderson didn't respond to requests for comments, and GM declined to make him available. In a statement provided by GM, Anderson said he was concerned that he might be perceived as a Silicon Valley cowboy pew-pewing his way through GM. While some tension is inevitable through transformations, the team understands, appreciates, and is already making great strides as it accelerates and broadens the pace of innovation, he said. Anderson codes in his free time and plays in a Silicon Valley hockey league. Wimbera has spent her entire career at GM, starting there in college more than 40 years ago. Anderson has moved around, working at McKinsey before joining Tesla in 2015. At Tesla, Anderson led development of the Model X SUV in the company's autopilot system. He butted heads with Musk as the two worked to develop cars that drive themselves. In 2016, he resigned from Tesla in part over the company's marketing of a new self-driving feature. Tesla sued Anderson, accusing him of taking proprietary documents and improperly colluding to recruit autopilot employees to work at Aurora. Anderson said the lawsuit was meritless. Aurora eventually agreed to pay Tesla $100,000 as part of a settlement. Anderson went on to spend nearly a decade at Aurora and led development of a LiDAR system that bounces lasers off objects to capture surroundings in 3D. Aurora has self-driving trucks on the roads in Texas. The vehicles are delivering freight between Fort Worth and El Paso and Dallas and Houston, as well as hauling fracking sand on public roads and highways in the Permian Basin. The company has hit most of its milestones, but it has also faced setbacks. In spring 2025, 2 weeks after putting trucks on the road without drivers, Aurora had to add human observers at the request of one of the manufacturers it partners with. Aurora's share price has languished amid questions of how readily it can amass customers. It's easy to underestimate the complexities involved in integrating autonomous technology into vehicles, said Ofer Sampson, a former Aurora executive who worked closely with Anderson and later spent a year at GM. Anderson was able to juggle all those aspects, from safety engineering to aerodynamics, while winning over often cynical executives at automakers and trucking companies, Sampson said. At one point, he said, as Aurora raced to finish a demo truck for a major customer, Anderson showed up at the shop in Pittsburgh to help finish the job. The executives heard he was really involved in turning screws and bolts. It went over really well, he said. He did not come in as chest beating. We are Silicon Valley and we know how it's done. This is the Wall Street Journal on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Now continuing on. China, how Beijing built arms industry to rival the West. New jet engines show results of China's military self-sufficiency push by Chun Hang Wang. In 2016, Beijing launched a new aerospace conglomerate called Aero Engine Corporation of China. It had a challenging mandate to develop top-line aircraft engines, a technology China had long struggled to master. Less than a decade later, Beijing's newest stealth fighters are entering service with what officials call Chinese hearts or indigenously made engines. The progress marked a milestone in China's quest to forge an arms industry worthy of a rising global power. For years, China's rise obscured a sobering reality. It couldn't make all its own weapons. Beijing is now not only producing its own armaments, it is also selling more abroad. In some military technologies, China appears to be matching major arms producers such as Russia and the US, or even pulling ahead. The ability to churn out advanced armaments is a key element in Chinese leader Xi Jinping's vision of making his country less reliant on the outside world for everything from food and energy to semiconductors. A more self-reliant China is essential for preventing Western nations from locking it into a strategic stranglehold, Xi has argued. 2 decades ago, China imported more arms than any other country, according to the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, or SRIPI, an independent think tank. China used to rely on the likes of Russia and France for warplanes, aviation engines, and air defense systems, and even struck deals to buy military hardware from the US in the 1980s, including radar systems and artillery technology. But China's share of global arms imports has fallen significantly, and the Asian power has dropped out of the world's top 10 buyers in recent years, according to SIPRI data. Analysts say China can now produce most of the military technology it needs, even if it continues using some foreign hardware for cost or quality reasons. This strategic success puts China in a stronger position to wage war in the event of a superpower conflict. It reflects Beijing's efforts to boost scientific research, restructure its state-run arms industry, and tap private businesses for defense needs. China has also closed some technological gaps through espionage and illegally reverse engineering imported gear, Western officials and analysts say. U.S. officials have disclosed what they describe as Chinese cyber attacks aimed at stealing U.S. secrets in aerospace, maritime, and other technologies. Chinese used every trick in the book, said Simon Wiseman, a senior researcher in SIPRI's arms transfers program. Beijing is now the world's fourth largest arms exporter, trailing only the US, France, and Russia, according to SIPRI data. Chinese hypersonic missiles, which can travel at least 5 times the speed of sound and evade most air defenses, exceed Western capabilities. China has always adhered to the principles of independence, self-reliance, and indigenous innovation in weapons equipment development, relying on its own strength for research, development, and production. The Chinese Defense Ministry said in response to queries. Beijing's arms programs, it said, are entirely meant for safeguarding national sovereignty, security, and development interests. State moves. China's Communist Party has craved military self-sufficiency since taking power in 1949. Although it developed its own nuclear and ballistic missile capabilities under Mao Zedong, it remained behind in other modern military technologies. a Western embargo on arms sales to China after the deadly crackdown on the Tiananmen Square protests in 1989 complicated the task for Beijing. Subsequent Chinese leaders have stepped up spending to procure foreign technology and support indigenous weapons development. Since the 1990s, China bought Russian Sukhoi 27 fighters and reverse engineered them to make its own version, the J-11s. Rostec, a Russian state-owned defense conglomerate, later accused China of illegally copying Russian military hardware, including Sukhoi planes. In 2016, a Chinese aviation executive pleaded guilty in the U.S. to conspiring to hack and steal data from American defense contractors, including information on the C-17 transporter, as well as the F-22 and F-35 stealth fighters. Beijing also reorganized its defense industry, which was dominated by state giants that had struggled with inefficiency and corruption while resisting government efforts to foster collaboration with civilian partners. Aero Engine, which is also known as AECC and was sanctioned by the US in 2020 and 2021, was created by pooling top scientists and resources from dozens of aerospace companies and research institutes. Beijing infused the new conglomerate with billions of dollars to compete against the likes of General Electric and Pratt & Whitney. Beijing also merged two state-owned firms to create the world's largest shipbuilder. Such moves helped China accelerate its development of homemade aircraft carriers, submarines, and warplanes, such as Beijing's second stealth fighter, the J-35, whose public debut in 2024 meant China was joining the U.S. as the only nations operating more than one model of stealth fighter. New thrust. Mastering jet engines was one of the biggest challenges. A top Chinese military test pilot told a Chinese newspaper in 2016 that domestically made engines struggled with insufficient thrust, high fuel consumption rates, and poor reliability. AECC boosted research collaboration with Chinese universities and said it tapped new technologies, including artificial intelligence, to speed up engine design and testing. State media portrayed AECC engineers as inspirational figures helping China break a Western technological monopoly. These efforts have started to pay off. Newer variants of Chinese jet fighters, originally designed with Russian engines, including so-called fourth-generation fighters like the J-10 and J-11, have been fitted with engines developed and produced by Chinese entities that were brought under AECC. China's first fifth-generation stealth fighter, the J-20, was displayed with a Chinese engine for the first time in 2021, roughly 5 years after the jet's official unveiling. The new J-35 stealth fighter, a rough equivalent of the American F-35, is equipped with Chinese-made engines, according to a recent state television program. Beijing has also displayed a new variant of its Y-20 heavy transporter, equipped with Chinese-made engines, replacing Russian models. AECC-affiliated researchers are pushing to develop advanced propulsion technology, including a class of engine that can transition from low speed to hypersonic modes, according to procurement documents obtained by researchers at Georgetown University's Center for Security and Emerging Technology. U.S. engines still tend to be an order of magnitude better in terms of reliability, being able to operate for many more hours before requiring overhauls, according to Steve Russell, general manager at GE Aerospace's Advanced Military Projects Unit, Edison Works. Nonetheless, China has a lot of smart engineers too. They're working fast, Russell said at a recent think tank discussion. They are getting smarter. While it is hard for Western analysts to decisively determine how advanced some of China's domestically made arms are, Clues emerged in a skirmish between Pakistan and India in May, when Pakistan's Chinese made J-10 fighters reportedly shut down some Indian warplanes, including at least one French-made Rafale jet using Chinese radar-guided missile. It was the first known aerial victory that a Chinese-made jet scored against a Western fighter. State broadcaster Chinese Central Television followed up days later by airing a two-part documentary, The Legend of the J-10, that recounted the fighter's development from the 1980s, calling it a sign that China's indigenous research and development system for military aircraft has matured. Precise circumstances of the shootdown remain unclear. Still, it proves what the Chinese and everyone else are saying. These are capable things and they are not to be trifled with, said Brendan Mulvaney, director of the China Aerospace Studies Institute, a U.S. Department of the Air Force think tank. Getting shipshape. China has also indigenized other military capabilities, including leapfrogging the U.S. and its ability to build warships quickly and cheaply. From 2015 to 2024, China's Navy launched 152 ships, while the U.S. launched 70. According to estimates by independent defense analyst Tom Shugart, the Chinese fleet is now the world's largest by number of vessels, although the U.S. Navy says its ships are still better. Beijing's third and newest aircraft carrier, the Fujian, is the first to be fully designed and built in China and features electromagnetic catapults for launching aircraft. Commissioned in November, it represents a market upgrade from China's first two carriers, which lack aircraft launching catapults that are standard on American carriers. The first Chinese carrier was refurbished from a Soviet-made hull purchased from Ukraine in 1998, while the second carrier's design was based largely on the first. Analysts say China still has some ways to go before it can outfit its entire military with domestically developed hardware. Soviet and Russian-designed aircraft still account for a significant share of China's inventory, including strategic bombers. Foreign-designed engines still power many Chinese warplanes and helicopters. Xi's thinking is that China remains the underdog in the military innovation industrial nexus compared with the U.S., says Tianming Cheng, a professor at UC San Diego who has written books on China's military and arms industry. But Xi's goal is for China to comprehensively challenge the U.S. for global military leadership eventually, Cheng said. Policy. Charlie Kirk's empire is lining up behind a J.D. Vance presidential bid. The vice president spoke Sunday at TPUSA's premier event, days after Erica Kirk endorsed him for 2028 presidential run. Before Charlie Kirk was fatally shot, he was readying for J.D. Vance to become the next president of the United States. Now Erica Kirk is determined to make that happen. In her kickoff remarks for Turning Point USA's first major event since his death, Kirk's widow told the 31,000 attendees, "We are going to get my husband's friend J.D. Vance elected for 48 in the most resounding way possible." The vice president closed the mega conference held here Sunday. Behind the scenes, Turning Point is setting up infrastructure to boost his potential 2028 presidential bid. The conservative group is planning to put representation in all of Iowa's 99 counties ahead of the presidential primary. Iowa is an important early state in the presidential nominating process, and Turning Point is already trying to build grassroots support for Vance there, according to Tyler Bayer, a top executive with the organization and a close friend of the late Kirk. Why mess around? Let the Democrats destroy each other in the primary process. While we benefit from the rare luxury of having a candidate that's so clearly the front runner, Boyer said in an interview backstage at the conference. Though he hasn't declared his intent to run for president, Vance, 41 years old, has put himself in position to be President Trump's successor. The author of the best-selling memoir, Hillbilly Elegy, worked in Silicon Valley before becoming an Ohio senator in 2022. The president has publicly and privately noted that Vance is his likely heir, often citing him along with Secretary of State Marco Rubio, with whom Vance has a close relationship. Rubio has said he wouldn't challenge Vance for the nomination. Adding the full weight of support from Turning Point's thousands of members, massive media operation and political organizing would give Vance another advantage. In remarks Sunday, Vance sought to tamp down internal divisions within the MAGA movement. During this weekend's events, debate erupted over free speech and anti-Semitism within the Republican Party. He took the side opposite Ben Shapiro, a popular podcaster who, during his remarks Thursday, called on party influencers to denounce rather than elevate figures such as Nick Fuentes, a white nationalist and Holocaust denier. President Trump did not build the greatest coalition in politics by running his supporters through endless self-defeating purity tests, Vance said. Every American is invited. We don't care if you're white or black, rich or poor, young or old, rich, rural or urban, controversial or a little bit boring, or somewhere in between. He, like former Fox News host Tucker Carlson, one of the speakers Shapiro criticized, said that Kirk's movement was about debate. Charlie invited all of us here for a reason because he believed that each of us, all of us, had something worth saying, Vance said, and he trusted all of us, you, to make your own judgment, and we have far more important work to do than canceling each other. Many of the Turning Point faithful seemed to share Charlie Kirk's vision for Vance. Interviews with more than a dozen attendees found most want to see Vance take over after Trump, or at least see him as the clear front runner. Kirk's support of Vance was a good sign for Marianne Goring, 72, a retiree from Houston. I think he had a good read on people. He had a good intuition about their hearts, about what they were about. Her husband, Don Goring, also a 72-year-old retiree, said Vance's working with Trump had him help prepare for stepping in. Turning Point, the youth outreach organization Kirk founded, has grown dramatically and now includes faith, media, and voter outreach arms. White House Chief of Staff Susie Wiles said the group's 2024 Get Out the Vote operation made the winning difference with reaching young voters and bringing out Trump voters in battleground states like Arizona, where Turning Point is based, and Wisconsin. Both states swung back to Trump after voting for Joe Biden in 2020. The organization plans to expand for next year's midterms and in 2028. Last year, Trump increased his margins with nearly all demographic groups, including winning outright young men, a major focus of Kirk's. Brooklyn Allard, a 20-year-old college student from Anchorage, Alaska, said she felt Vance could help excite young people after Trump's polling with the demographic has dropped. He's younger, so he is a lot more relatable. He kind of understands us a little bit better, Allard said. While Allard slightly prefers Vance, she said she would also be happy with Rubio. Most attendees the Wall Street Journal spoke to said they would also like to see a Vance Rubio ticket. A handful of attendees said even though Vance appeared to be the front runner, they didn't want him to be crowned as the Republican nominee already. I do want to see a primary because you just never know, said Lindsay Bowden, 42, who works for a skincare company. J.D. Vance, if the election were held today, he would get my vote, but am I open to the possibility of someone else? Sure. Turning Point was instrumental in Vance's elevation in politics. Charlie Kirk's endorsement of Vance in the Ohio Senate race helped propel Vance from obscurity. Kirk then introduced him to donors and later to confidants of Trump's inner circle and pushed for Trump to nominate Vance for vice president. Kirk was empathetic about his desire for Vance to be the next president. The two stayed connected by near daily text messages and in group chats. After the shooting on September 10, people in those conversations posted prayers for Kirk, alerting Vance to the tragedy. Vance went into the Oval Office to tell Trump that Kirk had been shot. He quickly flew to Utah to escort Kirk's body to Arizona on Air Force Two. Vance has a roughly 40 percentage point lead over the rest of the field in the Real Clear Politics average of polls, with almost everyone else below 10% support. For Democrats, California Governor Gavin Newsom and former Vice President Kamala Harris are the top of the varied list. A survey by The Argument Verisite released earlier this past week showed New York Democrat Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez with a slight lead over Vance in a hypothetical 2028 presidential matchup. The progressive congresswoman told reporters outside the Capitol that it was early, adding, "Let the record show, I would stomp him." Those close to Vance say he's focused on keeping Republican control of the House and Senate in the 2026 midterm elections, while also serving as finance chairman of the GOP, a position that puts him in touch with the country's wealthiest conservative donors. He plans to continue that next year and speak at rallies to sell the president's tax bill, which currently doesn't poll well among voters. Vance's office declined all interview requests, but people close to him caution that it isn't certain Vance will even run for president. Also, a poor showing by Republicans in the midterms could open the field for rivals of Vance if he stakes his political future on the outcome. The House majority is seen as up for grabs, and the Senate, while a long shot, is believed to be somewhat competitive. America's U.S. Coast Guard chasing another tanker involved in shipping Venezuela oil. Operation comes as the administration carries out Trump's order to blockade Venezuela's oil shipments by Costas Paris and Shelby Holliday. The U.S. Coast Guard is pursuing an oil tanker involved in transporting oil from Venezuela, according to three U.S. officials, part of an accelerating effort by the Trump administration to block ships from moving the country's crude. The attempted interdiction comes a day after the U.S. apprehended an oil tanker that wasn't on its sanctions list, and after President Trump, in a social media post last Tuesday, ordered a total and complete blockade of sanctioned tankers going into and out of Venezuela. One of the officials said the tanker under pursuit was previously sanctioned and part of the so-called dark fleet of vessels involved in moving oil from Venezuela. The ship was flying a false flag to disguise the country where it was registered and is subject to a judicial seizure order, the official said. Two other officials identified the ship as the Bella One, a very large crude oil carrier, or VLCC, which was sanctioned by the U.S. in 2024. The flurry of moves against tankers signaled the Trump administration was escalating its pressure campaign against Venezuela. Trump has demanded President Nicolas Maduro stop sending gang members and migrants to the U.S., halt drug trafficking, and the return of former U.S. assets nationalized decades ago. He has also privately pressured the Venezuelan leader to step down. Venezuela has rejected the U.S. demands, calling the moves against the ships serving its oil sector illegal. About 70% of Venezuela's oil exports rely on the fleet of sanctioned vessels that is increasingly being targeted by the Trump administration, and the U.S. actions strike at the heart of Maduro's grip on power by threatening oil revenues vital to the regime. The Bella One's registered owner is Istanbul-based Louis Marine Shipholding Enterprises SA, according to shipping data and analytics provider KPLR. The company didn't immediately respond to a request for comment. The vessel was one of three crude carriers that were heading to Venezuela, but turned around last week to avoid detection, when U.S. officials said. In the separate operation Saturday, the Coast Guard boarded a Panamanian-flagged oil tanker named the Centuries that had been docked in Venezuela, according to Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem. The Centuries wasn't included on sanctions list from the U.S., U.K., European Union, or the United Nations, according to KPLR. Anna Kelly, a U.S. White House spokeswoman, said Saturday night in a social media post that the Centuries was a falsely flagged vessel operating as part of the Venezuelan shadow fleet to traffic stolen oil and fund the narco-terrorist Maduro regime. The apprehension of the Centuries suggests that the U.S. is using an expansive concept of sanctioned tankers in enforcing its policy, and that it is treating all tankers carrying Venezuelan oil as potentially subject to seizure, said Francisco Rodriguez, a Venezuelan analyst at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. This escalates U.S. policy into a de facto total naval blockade of Venezuelan oil exports, which would have major negative effects on the Venezuelan economy, he said. And that is all we have time for today. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I am Cicely Tiernan, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.